Today is Thursday, February 4th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, we take an in-depth look at vaccines around the world.
There's an old saying in clinical research, in God we trust, all others must provide data.
Also ahead, the International Criminal Court convicts Lord's Resistance Army Commander Dominique Ongwen of war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Dominique Ongwen has been found guilty beyond reasonable doubt.
Plus, why some Polish Catholics are leaving the church. These stories and more are next. Today, we're taking an in-depth look at vaccines around the world. The first vaccines against COVID-19 have gone mostly to wealthier countries. Now, several middle-income countries are getting their shots, too. Many of these shots come from Chinese and Russian drug makers, but critics note that these developers have not always been forthcoming with data on their vaccines' safety and efficacy. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
An indigenous nurse was the first person to get vaccinated in the Brazilian state of Amazonas. The shot came from Chinese company Sinovac. Tests in Brazil found the vaccine was about 78% effective in preventing life-threatening cases of COVID-19 and about 50% effective overall. Not bad, says Sao Paulo University microbiologist Natalia Pasternak.
We have a good vaccine. It's not the best vaccine in the world. It's not the perfect vaccine, but it's a good vaccine.
But tests elsewhere have been inconsistent. Early data in Turkey show 91% efficacy. In Indonesia, it was 65%. The vaccine's actual efficacy is a mystery because Sinovac has not publicly released the clinical trial results. That's concerning, says Vanderbilt University infectious disease professor William Schaffner.
There's an old saying in clinical research, in God we trust, all others must provide data. And we would certainly like to see the data.
Another Chinese company, Sinopharm, says its vaccine is 79% effective, but it has not released its data either. Several countries are welcoming the Chinese vaccines anyway, at least in part because most other vaccines have been snapped up by wealthier countries. Brazil's Butantan Institute tested the Sinovac vaccine. Director Dimas Covas says working with the Chinese company was the right move.
Because if we hadn't, we wouldn't have millions of doses on the shelves ready to be used.
The two Chinese vaccines were made using techniques that have been around for decades. The flu and rabies vaccines are made the same way, but that does not guarantee they are safe and effective for everyone, Schaffner says.
We're sure they are effective to some degree. Exactly how effective they are, particularly in older patients, who obviously are the persons who are going to be more severely affected, is something that we'd like to know a great deal more about.
Vaccines from drug companies Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech appear to be more effective than the Chinese shots. But those vaccines need to be kept extremely cold. That makes them hard to deliver in many parts of the world, notes Johns Hopkins University vaccine expert William Moss.
They're not the ideal vaccine, and particularly, you know, for many low and middle income countries.
The Chinese vaccines are stable at refrigerator temperatures. So too is Russia's Sputnik V. Like the Chinese companies, the Russian developers have been criticized for distributing the vaccine without sharing test results. But on Tuesday, they published a study in the medical journal The Lancet showing it was more than 91% effective. That puts it in the top tier, Moss says.
This is what we wanted to see. This is very encouraging, I think, data, and really good for the world to have another vaccine.
Welcome news in Argentina, Hungary, and elsewhere, where Sputnik V shots are already being given. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Israel leads the world in percentage of its population getting the vaccine. One-third of the population has already received a first dose, and authorities now say anyone over the age of 16 is eligible for the jab. But Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip have been largely left out. So far, the Palestinian Authority has received just 2,000 doses from Israel. Those shots went to frontline healthcare workers. Palestinians hope to start receiving larger quantities of vaccine later this month amid debates over who is responsible for inoculating Palestinians. For VOA, Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israel continues to move forward with its vaccination drive, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he hopes that 90% of Israelis over the age of 50 will be inoculated in the next 2 weeks. The campaign includes Arab citizens of Israel and Palestinians in East Jerusalem who are covered by the Israeli healthcare system. But close to 5 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip have yet to receive the vaccine. The first 2,000 Palestinians, most of them frontline healthcare workers, received a vaccine after Israel delivered the doses and promised 3,000 more in the next few days. Palestinian Health Minister Mai Al-Kaila said that medical teams will be first in line. She did not say the vaccines made by Moderna came from Israel, although both Israeli and Palestinian officials later confirmed it. The Palestinian Authority has contracted to buy millions of doses of the Russian Sputnik vaccine, which was supposed to have been delivered last month. Now officials say they hope it will come later this month. Palestinian officials say they're especially concerned about the densely populated Gaza Strip, where the virus has been spreading quickly and hospitals are on the verge of collapse. Officials said some of the first 2,000 doses were also sent to Gaza. The disparity between the Israeli and Palestinian vaccination campaigns has led to renewed calls on Israel to vaccinate the Palestinians as well. Phyllis Bennis of the U.S.-based Institute for Policy Studies told Al Jazeera that Israel, as an occupying power, is responsible for Palestinian health care.
Israel is obligated under international law, under the Geneva Conventions. Article 56 requires it to provide all the materials needed for public health and specifically preventive measures to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics, exactly what we're facing here.
Israeli officials say that according to the 1990 Oslo Accords with the Palestinians are responsible for their own health care. Israel will offer help if the Palestinians ask for it, they say, and that hasn't happened yet. The Oslo Accords gave Palestinians limited self-governance in the West Bank and Gaza. Speaking by teleconference to the World Economic Forum last week, King Abdullah of Jordan, where a majority of the population is Palestinian, said Israel needs to vaccinate Palestinians for its own good.
I mean, the Israelis have had a very successful rollout of the vaccine. However, the Palestinians have not. Well, if you look at the connectivity of the Israeli-Palestinian people, you can't vaccine one part of your society and not the other and think that you're going to be safe.
Some Israeli officials, including Defense Minister Benny Gantz, agree. They say that as long as tens of thousands of Palestinians continue to work in Israel and hundreds of thousands of Jewish settlers live in the West Bank, Israel should also vaccinate its Palestinian neighbors. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Next, in Pakistan, the government began administering the COVID-19 vaccine this week, saying it's on track to achieve its targets. As VOA's Aisha Tanzim reports from Islamabad, however, the opposition says the government is doing too little, too late.
After a year of uncertainty, Pakistan finally began its COVID-19 vaccination campaign, kicking it off with a ceremony attended by the Prime Minister. Late Tuesday, a single dose of China's Sinopharm was administered to a doctor. On Wednesday morning, select hospitals readied their staff in areas designated as inoculation sites. But in many places, delivery of the doses from the government's vaccine bank was delayed by more than half a day without an explanation. In the first phase, the government plans to administer 500,000 doses, all of them donated by China. The first doses of the vaccine will be provided to the frontline health workers who get the maximum exposure. After that, old people and then the rest of the population. Provinces are overseeing the vaccine rollout. The opposition has criticized the government's pandemic response, accusing it of taking too long to order the vaccines. In Sindh province, controlled by an opposition party called Pakistan People's Party, the chief minister complained there weren't enough doses for frontline healthcare workers. The government, whose ruling party controls the three remaining provinces, defended its handling of vaccine distribution. Imran Khan is the prime minister of Pakistan.
ये डिस्ट्रीब्यूट एक ही तरह हो रहा है यानी मुनसफाना तरीके से हो रहा है कि कोई ये ना समझे कि हमने ये जो हमारे पास 5 लाख वैक्सीन आई हैं इनको हमने किसी एक सूबे में ज़्यादा बांटा ये बिल्कुल मुनसफाना तरीके से इसका इसकी डिस्ट्रीब्यूशन हो रही है
In a country ripe with anti-vaccine conspiracy theories, doctors fear a bigger challenge might be to convince the population to receive their doses. Dr. Niaz Mohammed heads the COVID-19 ward in a local hospital.
Pakistani agar vaccination nahi lagate to definitely wo bar bar jo hai wo infect honge covid se aur jo immunocompromised log hain उनके लिए डेंजरस हो सकता है जो लोग जो है क्रोनिक डिजीज के साथ है जो बूढ़े लोग हैं
फॉर द नेक्स्ट फेज द गवर्नमेंट सेज इट इज गेटिंग 17 मिलियन डोजेस ऑफ द ऑक्सफोर्ड एस्ट्राजेनेका वैक्सीन थ्रू द ग्लोबल वैक्सीन पूल कॉल्ड कोवैक्स द यूएस इज अमंग द कंट्रीब्यूटर्स With a population of 216 million, Pakistan will need a lot more vaccines to achieve the 70% immunization it is aiming for. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Islamabad.
This is VOA. In the U.S., the Republican Party is facing deep divisions between its moderate and far-right wings. But Republican members in the House of Representatives have decided to stand by two lawmakers on opposing ends who have polarized the party. On Wednesday, Republicans voted to retain Congresswoman Liz Cheney as their number three leader. Cheney, the daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney, voted to impeach former President Trump, angering the party's far-right wing. But Republicans also said they'd fight against a push by Democrats to kick firebrand Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene off her committees. Taylor Greene, who is on the other side of the party from Cheney, supports the anti-Semitic QAnon conspiracy theory and has in the past supported calls for violence against Democrats. Democrats who control the House of Representatives told Republicans to either strip Taylor Greene of her committee assignments or they would hold a vote to do so themselves. Republicans refused, so that vote will go ahead today, forcing Republicans to either go on record to defend Taylor Greene or rebuke her. The top House Republican, Kevin McCarthy, has accused Democrats of a, quote, partisan power grab, end quote. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The International Criminal Court today convicted Dominique Ongwen, a commander of the Ugandan rebel group Lord's Resistance Army, of 61 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The LRA had abducted Ongwen as a young boy and forced him to be a child soldier. But judges at the court said that the adult Ongwen had acted out of free will in committing, quote, innumerable, end quote, crimes between 2002 and 2005. They said he commanded several hundred soldiers. ICC presiding judge Bertram Schmidt read the verdict.
Dominique Ongwen has been found guilty beyond reasonable doubt of a number of crimes committed in the context of the four specified attacks on the IDP camps of Pajule, Odek, Lukodi, and Bok. Attacks against the civilian population, murder, attempted murder, torture, enslavement, outrages upon personal dignity, pillaging, destruction of property, and persecution. A number of sexual and gender-based crimes he committed against 7 women, whose names and individual stories are specified in the judgment, who were abducted and placed into his household, forced marriage, torture, rape, sexual slavery, enslavement, forced pregnancy, and outrages upon personal dignity. And lastly, the war crime of conscripting children under the age of 15 into the senior brigade and using them to participate actively in hostilities.
Ongwen, wearing a tie and face mask, sat impassively in court, sometimes with his eyes closed, listening as the judgment was read out. A hearing in mid-April will consider a possible sentence, which could be up to life imprisonment. A decision is expected on that later this year. In Myanmar today, the military blocked Facebook and other messaging services in the name of ensuring stability. The move follows Monday's coup and the detention of elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
Myanmar's military blocked Facebook and other messaging services on Thursday to shut down dissent. It comes just days after they launched a coup and detained de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, saying it was a response to election fraud. Opposition to the takeover went viral on Facebook, with activists and others sharing images of hospital staff protesting and calling for the release of Suu Kyi, activists and others arrested from her National League for Democracy party. Facebook is used by half of Myanmar's 53 million population. The Ministry of Communication and Information says it will be blocked until Sunday. In a letter, they accused people on Facebook of, quote, spreading fake news and misinformation and causing misunderstanding. However, the disruptions were patchy and some got through the blackout with VPNs. Myanmar's leading mobile network operator, Norway-owned Telenor, said in a statement it had no choice but to comply. Facebook spokesman Andy Stone urged authorities to restore connectivity so that, quote, people in Myanmar can communicate with their families and friends and access important information. Suu Kyi has not been seen since her arrest in the early hours of Monday morning. Last night, she was charged for illegally importing communications equipment. Police said six walkie-talkies had been found in a search of her home that were imported illegally and used without permission. The chair of the ASEAN Parliamentarians for Human Rights called the charges absurd in a statement. Earlier in the week, an official from Suu Kyi's NLD party said she was under house arrest in the capital, Naypyidaw, but, quote, in good health. The military has given no word on her whereabouts. They have refused to accept the NLD's landslide election win in November, citing unsubstantiated allegations of fraud.
That was Libby Hogan of Reuters. In Poland, many Catholics are leaving their religion, citing the church's role in the country's politics, including the recent move to impose a near-total ban on abortion. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
Katarzyna Lipka is one of many Poles abandoning Catholicism, something she says is a political statement. The 35-year-old has marked many of life's milestones in the church, considered a symbol of freedom in communist times. But in November, Poland's courts pushed through a sweeping clampdown on abortion that bishops had lobbied for. Her main concern is one shared with many other young people, that the church's influence is reaching further into other areas of life.
I used to think being passive was enough. I just didn't take part in the life of the church. But when I started to hear hate speech directed at non-heteronormative people, I began thinking I need to speak up against what was happening.
Poland has seen a growing number of its 32 million Catholics turning away. Church officials stopped collating data on defections in 2010, so there is no nationwide total. But in Warsaw, more people filed to quit last November than in all of 2019. And the 577 applications to renounce between January and mid-December were nearly double the 2019 figure.
This is a pivotal moment in Poland.
It's a turning point for Poland. We are born Catholic in Poland, almost all of us. We keep being Catholic as a result of tradition, habit, pressure from families. We christen our children so that our parents do not complain. We get married in church to have a beautiful wedding. We become godparents because it is an honor. In reality, what we are doing is helping the church gain privileges by taking part in the life of the church, despite the fact that at the end of the day, we do not really believe.
The relationship between church and state in Poland is supposed to be independent and autonomous, but many Poles say this is not the reality. Reuters research shows that in more than 140 cases over the last 5 years, priests have displayed election posters on parish property or discussed elections during Mass, almost always in favour of the governing party. The Polish Bishops' Conference, which represents the church in Poland, declined to comment on the clergy's role in political campaigning, and the government said it remained impartial towards religious belief and protected freedom of religion.
That was Lauren Anthony of Reuters. Tokyo Olympics chief Yoshiro Mori apologized today for sexist comments he reportedly made about women talking too much, but he said he would not resign. That latest scandal is not the only problem to plague the Tokyo Olympics. Along with the coronavirus pandemic, the games have also gone massively over budget. And that is intensifying calls for big changes in how the Olympics are held, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, South Korea.
You probably already know the Tokyo Olympics were delayed a year because of the coronavirus. But you may not know about the long list of other problems the Games have faced, problems that are causing a lot of frustration in Japan. There was the expensive proposal for Tokyo's main Olympic stadium, which was ditched after it was widely mocked for resembling a bike helmet, a spaceship, and a turtle. There was the original Tokyo Olympics logo, which was scrapped after accusations it plagiarized the emblem of a theater in Belgium. Just this week, the president of the Tokyo Organizing Committee faced calls to resign over his recent comments that women talk too much in board meetings. And of course, there was the coronavirus postponement, which organizers say will cost nearly $3 billion.
Things have really spiraled out of control, and that was before COVID.
That is Victor Matheson, a sports economist. He estimates Japan will have spent about $35 billion on the Olympics, shattering the original $7.5 billion budget. But Tokyo is not alone. According to a recent Oxford study, every Olympics since 1960 has gone over budget by an average of 172%. The situation has added more urgency to calls for radical changes in how cities host the Olympics. Many now see the Games as a debt trap, leaving vacant or underused sports venues and other facilities when the Games wrap up. That helps explain the steady decline in the number of countries bidding to host the Olympics. Whereas the 2004 Olympics attracted 11 bids, that number dwindled to 5 for the 2020 event. For the 2026 Games, there were just 2 candidates. So what can be done about it? One person with some suggestions is economist Andrew Zimbalist. He proposes naming permanent host cities for the summer and winter games, or designating several rotating sites.
So that you don't have to rebuild the Olympic Shangri-La every 4 years to some other place in the world, which is financially very costly and it's environmentally costly.
Zimbalist also says the International Olympic Committee, or IOC, should contribute more money, such as television revenue, to cities hosting the games.
It used to be the case that the IOC shared the bulk of television revenue with the host city, 70-80% of it. These days, they're sharing close to 20%.
In an email to VOA, the IOC defended its approach, saying it recently undertook reforms meant to discourage cities from building unnecessary venues. It said for the 2024, 2026, and 2028 games, more than 90% of the venues will be existing or temporary. And it said it was open to the games being held in different cities, regions, or countries. But Zimbalist says for Tokyo, that may be too late.
They were hoping for a public relations boost from hosting the games. Maybe they can rescue some of that. It's pretty clear that $30, $35 billion investment is going to waste one way or the other. There's not much they can do about it.
For the Tokyo Games, most of the bill will fall to Japanese taxpayers, and they do not seem thrilled. Recent polls have suggested most Japanese want the games postponed further or canceled. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our editor, Paul Alexander, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.